From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The transition from the presidency of Bill Clinton to that of George W. Bush brings with it another changing of the guard in Washington. Such news organizations as the New York Times, the Washington Post, ABC News, CNN, the Austin Statesman Journal, and others will be dispatching new correspondents to the White House. They will have to quickly learn the ropes of the highest profile beat in journalism. Bob stopped into the White House briefing room this week for a glimpse of what the fresh meat has in store.
And we don't have anything scheduled, but the team will be in touch with Arab leaders and with others. The team will be. I'm not sure he will, but if he does make calls, I'll let you know.
As Press Secretary Jake Seward spars with reporters about the details of the Mideast peace process, you can't help but notice that the White House press room, this epicenter of the New World Order, is a cramped and stagnant hole. From the familiar blue drape that hangs off kilter behind the podium, to the wobbly old movie theater seats the reporters sit on, to the faint smell of electronic circuitry and stale sandwiches, this place seems more like the epicenter of, Flint, Michigan.
The air isn't even very good in here. The ventilation system leaves a lot to be desired. The machines are often out of soft drinks. And the food in the machine is not something you really want to eat.
ABC's John Cochran, who is finishing his third tour of duty here, is quick to scoff on environmental grounds alone at any characterization that the White House beat is full of glitter and dazzle. Likewise, Claire Shipman, his opposite number at NBC.
It can seem from the outside quite glamorous, and it can seem that there will be constant drama. I think the truth is a lot of the day-in and day-out work here at the White House can be boring, it can be tiring. It's tough.
So what are you eating?
I'm eating tofu and vegetables. It's our daily diet here at the White House.
Food on the fly, it turns out, is one of the few elements of the beat that a reporter can count on. Life in the bunker has all the elements of a hostage situation. Cramped little cells for workspaces, sleep deprivation, and, as Alex Keita of the Dow Jones Newswire observes, every sadistic caprice of your captors.
You are here at the president's whim, more or less. If he decides to go golfing, that's it. He goes golfing. It's hard to plan a day.
Of course, leading the press corps from place to place, briefing to briefing, photo op to photo op is central to every administration's strategy for managing its message. That's why, NBC's Claire Shipman says, fighting off boredom is the least of her battles.
I think the harder thing to fight is the message that the White House is constantly trying to hand out to you. It's hard to step back and say, hey, that might be their story, but that's not my story.
You have to cover the White House, both from within the White House and without.
ABC's John Cochran.
You need to get away and talk to other people about the administration, because just because the president says this is something that's at the top of my agenda, it doesn't necessarily mean that's what should be at the top of the agenda.
That journalistic tactic may defeat the problem of not being able to see the forest for the trees, but there's that other problem, being so lost in the woods in search of details or the long view or whatever that your competitor scoops you like a vat of ice cream. Ben Bradley has supervised a White House correspondent or two in his years as executive editor of the Washington Post, and when I paid him a quick visit, he had some ready advice for incoming correspondents on knowing what the competition is working on.
You can know what each other is up to if it's for instance, where's the New York Times guy at the photo op? Is he not there and you are? Tilt?
So it's simple. All you need to do to cover the president is surrender your personal freedom, resist being spun like a top, leave your post frequently while missing absolutely nothing, and never, ever, ever get scooped. All from this godforsaken hovel atop a dried-up swimming pool, fetchingly close to yet light years away from the corridors of unimaginable power. In other words, it's basically impossible. On the other hand, virtually every major story in the world wends its way through these decrepit digs. Reporters here are genuinely, as perhaps no other press corps anywhere, eyewitnesses to history. Furthermore, there are perks, Back in the press room, I spoke to CBS radio veteran Mark Knoller, who has been on the beat for every president since Gerald Ford.
What's the single coolest thing that has happened to you as a consequence of having this beat?
Well, I guess it's the very first time that the President of the United States calls you by name.
And who was the first president to call you Mark?
Jimmy Carter.
And did you say, yo, my man, Jimmy?
Didn't say it, but I might have thought it.
Knoller hastens to add that you get used to such ego-stroking gestures and soon become immune to them. But clearly, when the new blood shows up in the press room in 2 weeks, they'll discover that boredom and stale lunches are only part of the story. Ben Bradley.
If you caught sitting there doing nothing, playing cards, get out, or you're in the wrong place. Get out of there. If you don't think covering the White House is interesting, you ought to be pumping gas.
I should. Maybe can I announce that we'll have a briefing tomorrow morning? 11 a.m. Thank you.
Helen Thomas recently became a columnist for Hearst newspapers, but she still retains the coveted seat front and center in the briefing room she's held for 4 decades as White House reporter for UPI. And that time, she's interrogated Presidents Kennedy through Clinton. Helen Thomas, President Clinton's former spokesman Mike McCurry, apparently said it was torture being grilled by you.
I'm glad to hear it. I didn't realize he was so complimentary.
What do you think of Clinton's briefing style?
Well, I think he's brilliant. He certainly has the facts at his fingertips, and I've never seen him really at a loss for words except for some of the Monica Lewinsky questions, which where he'd draw a deep breath and hesitate a moment. But he's so learned and knowledgeable that he can field anything we can throw at him.
What do you think of the president-elect? How do you expect him to hold up in the briefing room?
I think that he ought to be able to answer all the tough questions that he hasn't gotten so far. I think that people have been pretty easy on him, but that's because he's not yet president.
Several commentators were startled by this Helen Thomas moment at a recent Bush press conference right after he emerged from the meeting with President Clinton about the transition. We have a little clip of that.
I'm humbled and honored, and I can't thank the president enough for his hospitality. He didn't need to do this.
Yes, he did. He was doing Uriah Heep too many times. You didn't have to invite me. You didn't have to invite me. He said it 3 times, and then I said, yes, he did.
Why did you say that?
Well, because it's true. I mean, invite reporters in. What are we supposed to be, puppets? I think we should take any chance we can to question these people who run our lives and run the government.
What do you think is your most memorable confrontation with the president, the time when you felt the most frustrated?
I think that when a big defense budget, military budget, was presented in the press room by President Bush after the Cold War was over, Berlin Wall had fallen, peace was at hand. He presented a huge military budget, and I said, who's the enemy? I don't bow and scrape to these people. I mean, they're just like us. They're working for a living. They have a very vaunted position, that's true, but they're still our public servants. And we, too, are public servants in the sense that we are trying to find out what's going on. We're the only institution in our democracy where a president can be questioned on a regular basis. Nobody else gets that close to him or has that privilege. So he should be questioned. It's always been him so far.
Who was the easiest president to cover?
None.
Who?
They're not easy because they think they're president. Why don't we end this on a hopeful note? I would like to feel, and I hope, that the new administration will understand the role of the press, will not cut us off, that our questions are legitimate, and that they cannot operate in total secrecy, which they seem to be wanting to do lately.
And what about your colleagues in the press corps? Are there any things you want to say to them?
I respect my colleagues. And they certainly can think of very tough questions, even tougher than mine sometimes.
The torturous Helen Thomas?
I like that. Ah, me. What an image, huh?
Helen Thomas, Thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
There was a time when you existed in either Eastern Time or Pacific Time, with a vague nod toward the Central and Mountain time zones. But now, the rhythm of life is dictated by the universal feed time, as in when the network feeds the programming in your area. All this occurred to Matt Selman earlier this week.
December 31st, 2000, 11:55 p.m. My girlfriend and I are about to ring in the new year from the best night spot in Los Angeles, bed. On TV, we look for an official New Year's Eve countdown show. Channel 2, no countdown. Channel 4, no countdown. ABC has Dick Clark in Times Square, rocking in the new year. On a 3-hour time delay. That's not now. That's yesterday. Right now in New York, it's almost 3 a.m. Dick Clark could be dead. Keep clicking. Channel 5, nothing. Well, Fox has a countdown. Also in Times Square. Also in the past. Back to Dick Clark. Girlfriend says, change it. He's gross. Back to Fox. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Happy New Year,
2001. 3 hours ago, a giant ball slides down a giant pole. 3 hours ago, drunk New Yorkers cheer. How many of them are dead by now? Most of them, probably. Kiss girlfriend goodnight. Lights off. Think about stuff in head before sleep. Los Angeles TV has no live New Year's Eve countdown show. What does this mean? LA runs on hype, but it isn't hyping New Year's Eve 2001. Well, good for LA. New Year's should be ignored. After all, doesn't New Year's always fail to live up to its own hype? Don't most revelers end up depressed, let down? Don't most end up dead? But not in L.A. No way. For us, New Year's Eve is over 3 hours before it's even begun.
Matt Selman is a writer for The Simpsons on the Fox Network.
Coming up, the man responsible for that constant ringing in your ears has died. So has the magazine called George. And we may see the demise of Modern Ferret magazine pretty soon. You can listen to the show at onthemedia.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
Welcome back to NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. The man who took electronic conversations on the road has died. From ratchet-jawing CB fans to walking and talking cell phone users, Al Gross had an incalculable impact on the way we communicate. From WCPN in Cleveland, David C. Barnett has this appreciation of the man who made the world wireless.
Every time you hear that sound, you can thank or curse Alfred J. Gross. Electrical engineer Ted Rappaport got his first inkling of Al Gross's historical significance 10 years ago at a radio conference in St. Louis. The 70-year-old inventor invited Rappaport up to his room, where he opened up a suitcase full of electronic gadgets. There was a prototype walkie-talkie from the 1930s and a 1950s vintage shortwave receiver that would fit in the palm of your hand. An assortment of devices developed decades before they went into popular use.
Well, Al was a real tinkerer and had such an enthusiasm and love for discovery and creativity.
Ted Rappaport runs the Mobile and Portable Radio Research Group at Virginia Tech University, and he says Al Gross's patents form the basis for most portable communications today. Some of those patents go back to his days as a teenage hobbyist in a Cleveland basement. Gross went on to study electrical engineering at what is now Case Western Reserve University and was later commissioned by the government to adapt his walkie-talkie concept for military use.
Afterwards, with government funding to develop his ideas, he realized that there could be a consumer market for handheld personal communications. And he was able to lobby the commissioner of the FCC to create what became the first citizens band.
Yeah, Breaker 19, this here's a rubber duck. You got a copy on me, Big Ben, come on.
After laying the groundwork for the citizens band culture of the 1970s, Al Gross developed another wireless wonder.
Al designed what I believe is the first paging system in the world in the Long Island Jewish Hospital back in 1950, 1951.
In an interview last spring, Al Gross recalled that the doctors wanted nothing to do with his paging invention.
Because it would disturb their golf game or it would disturb the patient. So it wasn't a success as I thought it would be when it was first introduced. But that changed later.
There are now 45 million pagers in use in the United States alone. You can also credit the growing number of cell phones to the early patents of Al Gross. And then there's the story that Al liked to tell about an invention that made the comic pages. Ted Rappaport says this tale has become legendary.
He had come up with a little radio receiver that he put on a wristwatch strap. And what I understand from Al is that the creator of the Dick Tracy cartoon, Chester Gould, wanted to go visit Al and see what his wristwatch communicator was. And shortly thereafter, Dick Tracy was wearing a communicator wristwatch in the Dick Tracy comic strip.
In recent years, Al Gross was a senior engineer for the Chandler, Arizona branch of Orbital Sciences Corporation, where he directed research in aerospace and satellite systems. His enthusiasm for creativity and invention didn't flag until the last few weeks of his life, when cancer finally claimed him, in late December, at the age of 82.
Al, it's that time. Come on up.
Just 8 months earlier, he had received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
I'm having a whale of a good time here. This is a peak in my career. 6-2 even, over and out. Thank you.
Of course, one might make the claim that it was a mixed legacy to be the father of beepers, cell phones, and other devices that keep us constantly connected. But Al Gross knew you could always use the off switch. For On the Media, I'm David C. Barnett in Cleveland.
Frazier has it at the top of the key. He penetrates, stops, puts it up, swish. Even a casual basketball fan knows those words describe an exact series of events. The player's court location, his actions, the outcome. Even the fact that the ball went in smoothly, no backboard or rim, what they now call nothing but net.
Thank Marty Glickman. Glickman, who died this week at the age of 83, broadcast basketball before there was an NBA and basically invented the language of basketball. He was the voice of almost every New York sports team at one time or another. Hear his call of O.J. Simpson, becoming the first running back to gain more than 2,000 yards in a season.
They're practically carrying him off the field. They're dragging him off the field. They're lifting him to their shoulders, and he's being carried off the field on the shoulders of his teammates. What a sight. The entire squad has run out on the field, and they've carried O.J. off the field on their shoulders. O.J. Simpson with more than 2,000 yards.
His influence on the games we watch today is indelible. First, there is the matter of progeny. He gave Marv Albert his first break. He coached broadcasters while at NBC. He was the first national sportscaster to come out of Syracuse University, which would later spawn Albert, Bob Costas, Dick Stockton, and hundreds more. He was also one of the first athletes to become a sportscaster, but a listener would never hear an aging jock recount his glory.
And it's UConn ball again. They can double the margin. They lead 10-6, Connecticut does, and they have possession of the ball. Now Kelly slows it down somewhat. Moses guarding him out near the midcourt line. Dribbles off to the left. Holds up. Into the post. A spinning jump shot by Williams. Miss, and there's a whistle. A foul underneath.
And oh yes, Marty Glickman was yanked from the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. He and a teammate, as Jews, were seen as an affront to the sensibilities of Adolf Hitler. As one member of a 4x400 relay team, his impact on the fields of play would have been short-lived in any case. What endures is his descriptions of those fields and how he taught us all to see the action even when we were just listening. George Magazine is going to fold. That story was broken this week by Inside.com, which called the magazine, started by John F. Kennedy Jr., that monthly testament to America's persistent crush on the Kennedys. David Carr writes on these matters for Inside.com, and he joins us now. Hello, David.
Hi, how are you, Brooke?
Very well. Now, JFK Jr. wanted to take the two worlds he lived in, celebrity and politics, and use one to get people interested in the other. So what was wrong with that plan?
He was only willing to play the celebrity angle up to a certain point. As somebody who had been covered in the tabloid press, he wasn't too interested in gossip. And, of course, if people are going to read a magazine about politics and celebrity, they'd want lots of nice, juicy gossip.
But they got a lot of tri-corner hats and cleavage on the cover each month.
I don't think anybody's unaffected by the sight of Cindy Crawford wearing a weird hat and not much else. But George confronted serious tempo problems. Let's face it, as a monthly magazine in a fast-moving business, if you look at their cover this month, they had Linda Tripp on their cover. Well, we just concluded the most interesting election of the last century, I'd say, and it's kind of a problem that they didn't have anything about it in their current issue.
Now, Tina Brown at Talk also seems to be enamored with the idea of making politics sexy, and that's also going south. Is there a lesson here?
Well, I think it's smart to point to Tina as somebody who got this started at the New Yorker and at Vanity Fair before it. And yes, it's been a little more difficult to talk magazine. The New Talk magazine just landed on my desk, and it's got more of Heather Graham than you'd ever imagine seeing. And I don't think she's probably interviewed on Social Security reform, although I can't be sure.
Now, getting back to George, would it have been more successful if it had been named John?
Yeah, but that was one of his founding tenets, is that it was not about him.
But John was a kind of brand. Maybe he wasn't enough of a brand. Oprah's O magazine is now the biggest success story of 2000. Martha Stewart's doing pretty well. We know that Rosie O'Donnell is going to be associated with McCall's and hoping to revamp that magazine to make more money. What is the lesson here, that you have to really be a brand to sell a magazine?
John Kennedy, when he was alive, was not willing to do the things. He took off his clothes once and posed naked in his magazine, and that sold a lot of issues. But in terms of being on the cover every month, he just wasn't willing to do it. Oprah, on the other hand, is a mentor of a legion of women and is more than willing to dress up and smile nice for the camera to move magazines. And I don't think the industry has ever seen anything like it. I don't know if Rosie O'Donnell's going to have the same success.
But if he had performed as a brand should, would the magazine then have been successful, you think?
I don't know. I thought it was a fairly weird idea for a magazine. It kind of had the head of the New Republic in the heart of Vanity Fair. And the problem with it is not so much readers. They had readers. They had 500,000 readers. But magazine ad buyers like to see things in nice little baskets, nice discreet little baskets. And George was number one in its category because it invented its own category. And people who buy the ads can't fit into a little category, don't traditionally do very well, and there's no natural ads for this.
And just one last question. Was there any article or any contribution in George that it will be remembered for?
I think the only thing I personally remember about it is that column in which he did pose naked with a piece of dangling fruit, and he called his relatives poster boys for bad behavior, which seems to suggest that my interest, along with the interest of a lot of its readers, was fundamentally about the Kennedy family and not about the magazine that he conceived.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
David Carr is a senior correspondent for Inside.com. The pressure of the magazine business bears down on glossies both large and small. A particularly bruising battle is underway for dominance in the ferret magazine market, as Bob recently discovered.
My name is Shelton Kroot, and I address you today not as an animal professional or a ferret expert, but as a citizen whom your decision today will greatly affect. About 3 years ago, I decided to introduce pets into my life.
However, the venue, a late December hearing of the New York City Council. The subject, legislation that would reverse city health regulations currently prohibiting pet ferrets within city limits. The inescapable lesson, ferret owners care deeply about their pets, which somewhat resemble elongated hamsters, but really, well, think Ronco's pocket otter.
Let's see, we have Nux and Trixie and Bosco da Gama, Balthazar, Cauliflower, Couche, and Gabrielle. They're not rodents. Their ancestors are polecats. They're in the weasel family. Basically, the animals that have that kind of wiggly kind of look.
Mary Schefferman knows just how deeply ferret owners care. From a four-bedroom house in Lake Grove, Long Island, a home office crammed with ferret cages, ferret tunnels, ferret toys, bags of totally ferret food, and seven slender, wriggling little vermin with names, she and her husband Eric publish Modern Ferret magazine. Since 1995, they have combined puckish wit and service journalism to explore everything from ferret heart disease to ferret-owning Playboy playmates to reviews of indispensable ferret products. Eric, the publisher, reads from the tag attached to one of them, a furry mechanical ferret.
I'm a little poop, pal. I'll tell you what I mean. Squeeze my little tummy, you'll get a jelly bean.
They poop jelly beans. Some people find it offensive. Yes.
The key is, though, that some people find anything at all to do with ferrets absolutely irresistible, which is why the Sheffermans had no trouble rallying witnesses for the city council hearings and why for 3 years they could do no wrong with Modern Ferret. They had the ferret lifestyle magazine niche locked up for themselves, and in 1999, right alongside The Economist and The New Yorker, Modern Ferret was judged by the influential media magazine Min to be one of the 12 best titles published in America. Credit genuine devotion, an offbeat editorial sensibility, and, of course, special issues.
On the right here, we have the ferret of the century, which was the Budweiser ferret. It was a very exciting issue for us.
And now, Budweiser's replacement for Louis the Lizard...
No.
The ferret!
That's who they picked?
Real ferrets don't actually say very much, although Mary tries her hardest to loosen Cauliflower's lips.
Would you come out and make a noise? Would you think about it?
When the ferret fails to cooperate, she, of course, jumps to his defense.
They have itch breaks. They get little itches, and then they have to stop everything, and you have to just wait for them. So he's having a little itch break.
Also, it's a weasel, and it doesn't understand what you're saying.
Well, I'm motioning to him to come out, and they do understand that. And he does actually know his name, right?
Mary and Eric, blissfully happy, if only marginally profitable, lived their dream. Then began the nightmare. Fancy Publications, the Time Warner of the pet magazine business, began to publish a competing title. The juggernaut behind Dog Fancy, Cat Fancy, and Horse Illustrated hit the newsstands with ferrets.
This is typical marketing stuff from them, but they describe About Ferrets. Ferrets is a bi-monthly publication devoted to helping you care for your ferret. It is the only magazine where ferret lovers can find in-depth, accurate, current information, seek advice, and interact with other ferret owners. Having launched several years after we had been out there, it's a little tough for them to say that they're the only magazine. This is our whole life's work here, and I'd like my life's work to not be treated as if it doesn't exist.
There is, of course, a limited audience, and even more limited number of advertisers, in the polecat journalism category. Eric and Mary found themselves living nothing less than the bruising consequences of media concentration. Fancy publications, according to the Sheffermans, quickly used its distribution muscle to squeeze Modern Ferret out of pet stores, costing them half of their paid circulation. And they say that Fancy's owner, Los Angeles entrepreneur Norman Ridker, has tried to intimidate them into folding.
Before they launched the Ferrets magazine, he actually took me and Mary out to dinner. And he went through this whole explanation of how he's run everyone else out of business in all the other categories that he's done. He told us stories about how he's, you know, sat across the table and, you know, bought someone's whole life's work for pennies on the dollar and watched them cry. And, you know, he really gave us the, we're going to crush you.
Ridker declined comment on the Sheffermans' charges, as did Ferrets Magazine's editorial staff. Putting aside right and wrong, however, clearly in the long run, there is no room for two sheriffs in Ferret Town. Complicating matters, Eric has a chronic digestive disorder that has sickened him for weeks at a time, and last year the Sheffermans were able to publish only two issues of Modern Ferret. Still, they pledge to press on.
I don't think we have a choice. Eric and I are very much committed to continuing with Modern Ferret, even if it comes to, you know, I have to go get a job outside the house, and we do this as a part-time endeavor. There's so many things about ferrets that if you don't care enough and it's not part of your life, that kind of intimacy with the ferrets makes you care very much about what you're publishing.
Would it be overstating the case to say that ferrets have actually given you a purpose in life?
That would not be overstating a fact at all. I know a lot of people that they don't need that. They don't need that kind of intense purpose. But I'm one of the people who does need that. And I think it's made me a better person, if I can say that.
But that may not be enough, because self-actualization doesn't pay the printing bills. In the end, it's a dog-eat-dog world out there, among other species.
Enjoy it while you can, hotshots. Your days are numbered.
Louie.
I know a lot of predators, and I know several very large ferrets.
Coming up, we're on the Word Watch this week for the end of the day. That's a phrase that's been reverberating in this millennial season, and we hope you'll send us more. Also, a talk with a columnist who's more interested in reaching policymakers than the public, and a day in the life of a reporter on the bummer beat. This is NPR's On the Media.
Welcome back to NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. At the end of the year, we've been hearing a lot about the end of the day. Reporter Tony Macillas has the latest in our series on Words to Watch.
The phrase, at the end of the day, is the Queen's English, literally. Queen Elizabeth II used it at the opening of a government building in 1982. In fact, it was a cliché as early as 1974, according to Evan Morris, the web's word detective and a nationally syndicated columnist.
Sort of overwhelmed the media over there, and everyone was saying at the end of the day, meaning sort of what we meant a few years ago when we would say the bottom line is.
Eventually, in the final analysis, when all is said and done, that's what at the end of the day means in the imprecise sense.
Universal time, 16 hours, 33 minutes, 55 seconds.
But there's no room for imprecision on Dr. Dennis McCarthy's watch.
My title is the Director of the Directorate of Time.
5 seconds.
Dr. McCarthy is the arbiter of time for the U.S. Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C. Congress made the observatory the official timekeeper for the country, and Dr. McCarthy oversees the master clock. In his world, the end of the day has a very specific meaning.
It's the time which is actually related to the mean solar time along the meridian of Greenwich. So the day there begins at 0 hours, 0 minutes, and 0 seconds coordinated universal time and would end, of course, with 23 hours, 59 minutes, and 59 seconds coordinated universal time.
Coordinated universal time is Greenwich Mean Time. So it seems England is responsible for both the literal and figurative meanings of at the end of the day. But a musical based on Victor Hugo's epic novel spread the cliché to the USA.
The specific trigger may have been the musical Les Miserables, which actually has a song in it called At the End of the Day.
At the end of the day, you're another day older.
The Word Detective says that the opening of the hit musical coincides perfectly with a sudden fourfold rise in the usage of At the End of the Day. The song comes early in the first act of one of the longest plays on Broadway. Not longest running, literally the longest. With three acts and nearly 3 hours of music, The End of the Day isn't close to the end of the play. In New York, I'm Tony Macillas for On the Media.
As the Clinton administration comes to the end of its day, and as we finally shake off the last remnants of the Al Gore campaign, a small item in Brill's content magazine reminds us of one loose end, a newspaper column written, but never published, by Democratic activist and multimedia pundit Susan Estrich.
According to her recent book, Sex and Power, the column was used as a bargaining chip in a grievance with the Gore campaign, raising questions about journalistic weapons in the hands of working political operatives. Estrich, a law professor at the University of Southern California, is also a contributor to Fox News, the Los Angeles Times, American Lawyer, and USA Today. Professor Estrich, welcome to On the Media.
My pleasure to be here.
I'm looking at your resume, and I see lawyer, academic, author, TV pundit, Politico, columnist. When you look in the mirror in the morning, who do you see?
I'm a law professor, a mother, and someone with a lot of opinions who's lucky enough to have many forums in which to express them.
All right, please put on your journalism hat for a moment. Do you find yourself negotiating some sort of hazardous minefields as you try to maneuver among your various roles in writing your newspaper column?
I think everybody's negotiating hazardous minefields these days, and I think there's more self-censorship than most of us would like to admit.
Well, listen, I'm not asking these questions for no reason.
Really?
I'm sitting here holding your book, Sex and Power.
Right.
And I get to page 3. And I find you discussing with yourself about whether you should write a column suggesting the nomination of Madeleine Albright for Secretary of
right.
State. And I guess ultimately you decided not to. But what strikes me is that your deliberations on this matter have to do not with which is most interesting as a newspaper column, but which is most likely to get Madeleine Albright nominated for the job.
Well, I think of myself as an activist, and I think of myself as someone who does have an agenda. I don't work as a reporter, per se, and I'm a journalist only in the sense that opinionated people in our society who are trying to affect change often use the news organizations or use their pens and papers or computers, in my case, to affect change. But I think, you know, I make no bones about that. That's who I've always been.
All right, here it comes. Calling your
the
attention,
hard one?
Calling your attention, Counselor, to pages 218.
I know where you're going.
Yeah. In your book, about in the chapter on political power, you talk of an episode
in which I didn't publish the column.
You were trying, as I understand it,
to get women hired in the Gore campaign, not to hurt the vice president.
All right, I just want to get this clear here. It says here in your book, I don't send the column to my syndicate or to USA Today, which has already offered to run a piece on Al Gore's women problem, sight unseen.
Right.
One last try. I send it overnight mail to the vice president himself,
right.
and I place a call to him, making it clear
that
I want to speak to the vice president himself, not to one of the princes. 2 days pass, no word.
Right.
USA Today wants to run a piece on the following Monday, but there's a problem. Anyway, on and on. The Gore campaign, from your perspective, caves.
Well, no, not caves. He's, I finally get to the vice president, and he, for the first time, has a discussion. I think it's probably the first time he'd had a discussion with anybody on the topic, and he says, you know, we got to do something.
And the column doesn't run.
Well, the column doesn't run,
Well, Professor, you're a lawyer. Isn't there a word for this sort of behavior?
Pressure?
Extortion?
I mean, you know, I think it depends on what you, where your starting point is. It is a tradition among those of us who take an activist role in politics to use the press and to use disclosures to the press and to go public with certain things and try to deal with other things privately. And that's what I did. My goal was not to make a name for myself in newspapers. My goal was to get the vice president to hire women.
Put yourself in the place not of academic, lawyer, mom, author, TV pundit, Politico, columnist, or anything else. Make yourself the editor of a national newspaper. Knowing what we now know, would you hire
you? Would I hire me? Yeah, I think I'm ethically cleaner than a lot of people who make no effort to separate or understand their roles. We've got a whole generation of journalists who purport to be reporters who spend half their time in my business, and you don't know what hat they're wearing when.
Professor Estrich, thanks very much.
I think the goal of anyone writing for us should be to influence who their opinions, not use the threat of the paper as leverage, or the threat of not writing something as leverage.
Brian Gallagher is editorial page editor for USA Today.
Now, in our conversations with Estrich since this whole issue came up, she has agreed with that premise.
As far as you're concerned, she's invited back?
If it is her view that it is appropriate to use the threat of a column on a routine basis to affect public policy, as opposed to simply stating her views, then we may have to reconsider that.
There are the five-star generals of newspaper journalism, big book writers like Bob Woodward and star columnists with postage stamp pictures like Jimmy Breslin. And then there are the infantrymen, grunts who pound the pavement on dreary stories for undistinguished papers like Mark Stamey of the New York Post. Stamey is short and square-faced, a middle-aged man from a broken home in Syracuse, New York. He ran his own business for a while, salvage diving. Then he went to college, earning master's degrees in sociology and journalism. He was already 45 by the time he became a reporter, freelancing first for the New York Times before landing the job at the New York Post. At the Post, he's covered fires, injured horses, fires, homicides, West Nile virus, evictions, and fires. Stamey was working the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade the day I spent with him. He pulled a sour face as Mickey Mouse, four stories high and six stories long, floated down Broadway.
I mean, that's it. The guy owns town here. Mickey Mouse took over 42nd Street. That's more than any gangster could ever do.
Stamey is cooling his heels at the parade, interviewing kids until something bigger happens. It does, and he's summoned back to the office a short walk away. As a foot soldier, he rarely writes a story by himself. In fact, he rarely writes a story. His job is to cover the story, go to the scene while another reporter is dispatched, say, to the press conference, and phone the facts, the quotes, and the color he gathers. He nurses a healthy resentment for his white-collar bosses back at the desk.
It's all right if I live in this world, but they don't want to even be brought, you know, aware of it. When I say you see, like, a dog licking human blood from the cracks of a sidewalk, I'm not inventing it. I mean, this is, we wait, well, sometimes we end up walking in gore and not knowing it.
Why do you do it?
I need the job. I think I would rather not do it. I mean, I need the money. I need the job. I need the...
You need this job.
I need
at the New York Post covering babies going out of windows.
No, I don't need... Nobody wants it. No, I don't have any joy in that, none whatsoever. I've been told on occasion I'm too stupid to write my own stories, and that the only thing I'm good for is driving the car. So they got me kind of pigeonholed as a roughneck street guy, and I don't belong inside. Let's see what delights they have for us now.
Now at the Post, Stamey is sent on another story by city editor John Mancini.
This could be a little heart warmer.
I can't wait.
Fred Nunez is 16 years old, but just barely, because he had a puffy jacket on, maybe not unlike yours. And somebody tried to, somebody did stab him for it, but they didn't get his jacket. Stabbed three times. He's in serious condition at Jamaica Hospital. Why don't you check, make sure he's still in the hospital. We're pretty sure he is, and then go see him. Maybe the family brought a turkey over and a nice new jacket for him or something.
Some bandages.
Yeah, so this could be...
Stamey climbs into his Jeep for the ride down to East New York. It's familiar territory to Stamey, the rundown districts on the city's fringes.
I spend a lot of time in a lot of these other, you know, outer boroughs.
And are you saying there's, like, there's no glamour, there's no romance, there's no sense of living your own drama in doing this kind of work?
You mean like, you know, the camera swooping around while the theme song plays in the background and here you are being grand?
Yeah.
No. Right. No, it's all like emptying the trash cans and changing the bedpans and... No, there's no glamour in this. I can't imagine. I wouldn't be able to fantasize it being glamorous.
We arrive at the apartment house of Fred Nunez and park by a garbage pile. The building isn't locked, so we walk right in.
They're at the hospital.
They're at the hospital. That's what I thought. I think I'll go there instead. Yeah. Do you know Fred?
Yeah.
Does anybody else here know him? Maybe talk to somebody who knows him? The neighbors?
1D.
1D? Downstairs? Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Happy Thanksgiving.
He was like our cousin.
Yeah? Yeah, I heard he's a nice guy. I heard he just got up for his coat. Yeah, that's not good. We're here to help if we can.
After the interviews and a quick trip to the hospital, he phones in from an emergency room payphone to dump the quotes his editors will assemble into a story.
Yes, I do. I'm at the hospital now. We were just told that we cannot go talk to the family. But this kid's under heavy security because the perpetrators are still, apparently, they're on the loose. But I went over to his building where he lived, and I spoke to people who knew, everybody knew him. Everybody had the same thing to say about this kid, uniformly very positive. So one of the mothers in the neighborhood that knew him well, her name is Juliet, J-U-L-I-E-T-T-E, Fisher, F-I-S-H-E-R, said, comma, quote, he got along with everybody, dash, all the kids like him, and I like him. It's such a tragedy for a coat. I'm afraid for my own son. He has a name brand coat, too. Period, close quote. Good enough. All right, we got it then? Thank you, Andy. Is Mancini still there? Who is he the one that tells me good night? Happy Thanksgiving, Andy. Bye-bye.
Having been good-nighted by his editors, he's free to go. So we take off. There's a diner off the highway on the way from Jamaica Hospital in Queens, not far from where Stamey used to live. They all know him there. I want to play the little jukebox mounted in our booth, but he doesn't. Stamey says he finds it hard to relax. He doesn't have a close-knit family or a sheltering circle of friends. In fact, and he's pretty embarrassed by this, the only regular engagements he attends are Friday night Mensa meetings.
When you're covering your sixth fire in as many weeks, do you ever think to yourself, does the public really need to know about this fire? I mean...
Yeah, but then again, there's always that. Yesterday I covered a fatal fire of an NYU student who fell asleep using aromatherapy candles. You know, if you don't know about that, you think, what a benign little thing. Would be healthy, asleep all night, have a nice glowing light there. Wake up and the whole family's dead. Seen this a lot.
But it's the other stuff. It's the catalog of miseries. You know, does that serve a social function, a positive...
Yeah. It's not just voyeurism, and it's not just intrusion so much as it is there's a need, and we can tell people about it, and then they feel it. More times than not, people have come forward to help.
especially if it's someone who's been killed, you say, what can you do? He's dead. And say, well, you want him to be forgotten? You know, just another toe tag.
You know, when I looked at your clips, fire after murder after...
train wreck after plane crash after defenestration after infanticide, parasite, homicide. I mean, come on. Whatever.
I thought, how can a person like that actually like their job, but you don't like your job?
I like it and I don't like it. The thing I like about my job is that it's infinitely challenging. It's a total 100% IQ test 100% of the time. Outwit all of New York City and get the story in the paper. What I hate is empathizing with the people whose children have been hurt. I mean, when people like are just so stricken with grief that they can't talk and they can't cry, they make this sound, they call it the cri du chat, the cry of the cat. It's like a non-verbal, internalized, anguished wail that freezes in their vocal cords. And that stays with you. It, like, stains you, you know?
Back on the road, Stamey says the urban spectacles he serves up daily have earned him a twitch and many sleepless nights.
Yeah, I never want to be on that side of the story, but I live in constant fear that it's going to happen. I'm going to get shot. I think myself I'm going to get shot. I think anything can happen to anybody at any time, but we go out looking for it.
He fantasizes about moving to Florida or Tahiti, but that's not going to happen.
I wish there was a 12-step program for journalism, because it's very much like an addiction. It's an addiction because it pulls you in, it beguiles you, it hooks you, and then it starts turning you inside out. And the rush is gone, and all that's left is the hangover. The hangover and the tedium, and you're just doing it like a zombie because that's what you do every day, that's what you did every day, and it's not going to change.
The next day, he was back on the beat, back on another story, and it ran under another shared byline. The headline read, Queen's Inferno Leaves Boy, 6, Gravely Injured.
That's it for this week's show. Remember, we're still on the prowl for words to watch. Please email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org.
The associate producers for On the Media are Janine Price, Katya Rogers, and Devorah Klar. On the Media's technical directors are George Edwards and Irene Trudell. Our producer is Mike Pesca. The senior producer is Arun Roth. We had help this week from John Keefe.
Bassist and composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. Our executive producer is Dean Capello. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Funding for On the Media is made possible by the Ford Foundation, the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, the Bydale Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This program is a production of WNYC Radio New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.